great stone archway that led into the bazaar, and paused to look up at it, giving his follower time to see where he was going, and strolled inside. Immediately, before the young man could see, he stepped into a little shop selling rugs and textiles. There were over 60 different lanes in the bazaar, and hundreds of shops. It wouldn't be hard to escape from his follower, but Malcolm wanted to do something different, to turn the tables and follow him. A few seconds later, the young man hurried in at the great gate and looked around, craning to peer along the crowded alley, looking quickly to left and right, too quickly to see anything clearly. He was agitated. Malcolm, among the hanging rugs, was facing away from the alley, but was watching in the back of his wristwatch, which consisted of a mirror. The rug seller was busy attending to a customer and gave Malcolm no more than a quick glance. The young man began to hurry along the alley, and Malcolm stepped out to follow him. He had a linen cap in his pocket, and he put it on now to hide his red hair. The lane they were in was one of the wider ones, but shops and stalls crowded close on both sides, and the whole alley was hung thickly with clothes, shoes, carpets, brushes, brooms, suitcases, lamps, copper cooking vessels, and a thousand other things. Malcolm moved unobtrusively through it all, following the young man without ever looking at him directly, in case he suddenly looked round. His nervousness surrounded him like a vapour. His hawk demon sat on his shoulder, her head twitching this way and that, occasionally seeming to face backwards like an owl, and Malcolm saw every movement, and moved closer and closer. Then the boy, he was hardly a man, said something to his demon, and Malcolm saw his face more clearly. And that raised an apparition in his mind, no more than the ghost of a memory of another face, and he was back in his parents' inn on a winter evening, as Gerard Bonneville sat by the fire with his hyena demon, and gave Malcolm such a warm smile of complicity that... Bonneville! This was his son. This was the magisterium's celebrated alethiometrist. Aster, Malcolm whispered, and his demon leaped up into his arms and climbed to his shoulder. It is, isn't it? He murmured. Yes, no doubt about it. The alleys were crowded, and Bonneville uncertain. He seemed so young, so inexperienced. Malcolm followed the boy into the heart of the bazaar, closer, closer, little by little, moving through the crowds like a ghost, unseen, unsuspected, unfelt, subduing his own personality, watching without looking and seeing without staring. Bonneville was becoming despondent, to judge by his bearing. He'd lost his quarry. He wasn't sure of anything. They came to a sort of crossroads, where an ornate fountain stood under the high arched roof. Malcolm guessed that Bonneville would stop there and look all around, and he did, Malcolm seeing it in his watch back with his head turned away. "He's drinking," said Aster. Malcolm moved quickly, and while the boy's head was still bent down to the water, he came to stand right behind him. The hawk demon was looking to left and right, and then, as Malcolm knew she would, she turned and saw him, only an arm's length away. It gave Bonneville a great shock. He jerked back and up from the water, whirled around, and there was a knife in his right hand. At once Aster sprang at the boy's demon and bore her down into the stone trough where the water ran. Malcolm reacted in the same moment, just as the razor-sharp blade sliced through the left arm of his jacket and the skin beneath. Bonneville had swung his hand so hard that he was off balance for a fraction of a second, and in that moment Malcolm slammed his right fist with all his strength into the boy's solar plexus, the kind of blow that would have ended a boxing match at once, and Bonneville, all breath and power gone, slumped back over the trough and dropped the knife. Malcolm kicked it away and picked the boy up with one hand, gripping his shirt front. "My knife!" Bonneville gasped in French. "It's gone." "You're going to come with me and talk," said Malcolm in the same language. "Like hell!" Aster's claws were firmly fixed in the hawk demon's throat. She gripped harder, and the hawk screamed. Both demons were soaking wet, and Bonneville was wet through himself and both frightened and defiant. "You've got no choice," said Malcolm. "You're going to come and sit down and drink some coffee with me and talk. There's a cafe just around the corner. If I'd wanted to kill you, I could have done it any time during the last 15 minutes. I'm in charge. You do as I say." Bonneville was winded and trembling, and hunched over as if his ribs were broken, which they might very well be. He was in no condition to argue. He did try to shake off Malcolm's grip on his arm without the slightest success. It had all happened so quickly that hardly anyone had noticed. Malcolm took him to the cafe and made him sit in the corner, his back to a wall hung with photograms of wrestlers and film stars. Malcolm ordered coffee for them both. Bonneville sat hunched forward, caressing his demon with trembling fingers, stroking the water off her feathers. "Fuck you, man," he muttered. "You've broken something. A rib or, I don't know, something in my chest. Bastard." "You've been in the wars, haven't you? How did you get that broken nose?" "Piss off." "What do you know about the murder of the patriarch?" said Malcolm. "Did Monsieur Delamere send you here to see it done successfully?" Bonneville tried to conceal his surprise.
"How do you know?"
he began, but stopped. "I asked the questions. Where's your lithiometer now? You haven't got it on you, or I'd know."
"You'll never have it."
"No, because Delamere will. You took it without permission, didn't you?"
"Fuck you."
"I thought so."
"You're not as clever as you think."
"Well, I dare say you're right, but I'm cleverer than you think. For example, I know the names and addresses of Delamere's agents in Constantinople, and now you realize I can follow you, you'll know that I'll very soon find out where you're staying. 10 minutes after that, they'll know."
"What are their names, then?"
"Aurelio Menotti, Jacques Pascal, Hamid Sultan." Bonneville gnawed his lower lip and looked at Malcolm with hatred. The waiter came with their coffee and couldn't help looking at the boy's wet shirt and bandaged nose and at the blood now seeping through the cut in Malcolm's sleeve.
"What do you want?"
said Bonneville when the waiter had gone. Malcolm ignored the question and sipped the scalding coffee. "I'll say nothing to Menotti and the others," he said, "if you tell me the truth now." Bonneville shrugged. "You wouldn't know if it was the truth or not," he said. "Why did you come to Constantinople?"
"Nothing to do with you."
"Why were you following me?"
"My business."
"Not after you pulled a knife on me. It's mine too." Another shrug. "Where's Lyra now?" Malcolm said. Bonneville blinked. He opened his mouth to speak, changed his mind, tried to sip his coffee, burned his mouth, put the cup down.
"So you don't know?" the boy said eventually.
"Oh, I know exactly where she is. I know why you're following her. I know what you want from her. I know the way you use the alethiometer. Know how I know that?
It leaves a trail.
Did you realize?" Bonneville looked at him narrow-eyed.
"Well, she discovered that straight away," Malcolm went on.
"You've been leaving a trail all through Europe, and they're following you, and eventually they'll pick you up." The boy's eyes flickered for a moment, in what would have been a smile if he'd let it.
"He knows something,"
thought Astor to Malcolm.
"Shows how much you know," Bonneville said. "Anyway, what's this trail?
What do you mean by that?"
"Oh, I'm not going to tell you."
"What does Delamere want?"
"He wants the girl.
Apart from that, what does he want to do with this new High Council?"
Why did Delamere want Lyra was the one question Malcolm wanted to ask, but he knew he'd never get the answer by asking it. "He's always wanted power," said Bonneville.
"That's all. Now he's got it. Tell me about the business with the roses."
"I don't know anything about it."
"Yes, you do. Tell me what you know."
"I'm not interested in it, so I took no notice."
"You're interested in anything that gives you any power, so I know you'll have heard about the rose business. Tell me what Delamere knows."
"It's no advantage to me to tell you anything."
"That's just what I mean. You're short-sighted. Raise your eyes to the horizon. It would be a great advantage to you not to have me against you. Tell me what Delamere knows about the rose business."
"What will I get in return?"
"I won't break your neck."
"I want to know about this trail."
"You can work that out for yourself. Come on, roses." Bonneville sipped his coffee again. His hand was steadier now.
"A man came to see him a few weeks ago," he said. "A Greek or a Syrian, I don't know. Maybe from further east.
He had a sample of rose oil from a place way out in Kazakhstan or somewhere. Lop-Nor. They mentioned Lop-Nor. Delamere had the sample analyzed.
Well, that's all I know.
That's not good enough. It's all I know. What about the business in Oxford that went wrong?
That was nothing to do with me.
So you know about it.
That's useful.
Delamere was behind that as well, obviously. Bonneville shrugged. He was beginning to regain his confidence. It was time to shake it again.
"Did your mother know how your father died?" Malcolm said.
The boy blinked and opened his mouth to speak, closed it again, shook his head, picked up his coffee cup but put it down again almost at once, seeing his own hand tremble.
"What do you know about my father?"
"More than you, obviously." The hawk demon shook herself away from Bonneville's hand and sprang to the tabletop, her claws gripping the tablecloth and pulling it into ridges. Her fierce eyes were fixed on Malcolm's, and Asta stood up on the chair next to his, watching her.
"I know you killed him," Bonneville said. "You killed my father."
"Don't be stupid. I was only 10, 11, something like that."
"I know your name. I know you killed him."
"What is my name, then?"
"Matthew Polstead," said Bonneville, with contempt.
Malcolm took out his passport, his genuine one, and showed the boy his name.
"Malcolm, see? Not Matthew.
I look at my date of birth. It was only 11 years before your father died. There was a great flood, and he drowned. As for Matthew, he's my older brother. He found your father's body in the Thames, near Oxford. He had nothing to do with killing him." He took back his passport. The boy looked both rebellious and disconcerted.
"If he discovered the body, he must have stolen my father's alethiometer," he said sullenly. "I want it back."
"I heard about an alethiometer. I heard about what your father did to his demon, too. Did you know about that? I thought it might run in the family."
Bonneville's hand moved to his demon's neck, to stroke it or hold her steady, but she shook her wings impatiently and moved away, further onto the table.
Asta put her front paws on the table and stood up, watching intently.
"What?" said Bonneville.
"Tell me."
"You tell me what I want to know first. Roses. Oxford. The alethiometer. The girl. The death of the patriarch. Everything. Then I'll tell you about your father."
The boy's eyes were glaring like his demon's. He sat tensely on the edge of his chair, both hands on the table, and Malcolm stared implacably back. After several seconds, Bonneville's eyes dropped, and he sat back and began to chew at a fingernail. Malcolm waited.
"What you want first?" said Bonneville.
"The alethiometer."
"What about it?"
"How you came to read it."
"When I was a kid, my mother told me about how my father had been given his by these monks in Bohemia or somewhere. They had it for centuries, but they recognized that he was a genius at reading it, and they saw he had to have it. When I heard that, I knew it would be mine one day, so I started reading all about the symbols and how to interpret them. And when I first touched the one the Magisterium has, I found I could read it easily. So they began to rely on me. I could read it more quickly and better, more accurately than anyone they'd ever seen. So I became their chief reader. I used to ask what had happened to my father, how he died, where his alethiometer was now, a lot of questions like that. They led me to that girl. That bitch has got it. They murdered him and she stole it."
"Who murdered him?"
"The Oxford people. Maybe your brother.
He drowned."
"The fuck you know about it, if you were only 10 years old?"
"Tell me about this new method."
"I just found it out."
"How?"
Bonneville was vain enough to respond. "You wouldn't understand. No one would unless they had a thorough classical training. Then you have to rebel against it and find something new, like I did. At first it made me throw up, and I saw nothing and felt nauseated, but I stuck to it. I tried again and again. I wasn't going to let it beat me. and in spite of being nauseated, I could make connections much more quickly. It became famous, my new method. The other readers tried it, but they could only do it weakly, uncertainly. They couldn't handle it. It was talked about all over Europe, but no one can do it properly except me.
What about the girl? I thought she could do it.
She's better than most, I admit that. But she hasn't got the strength. You need a kind of power, stamina, force. And I guess girls haven't got it.
Why do you think she's got the alethiometer that your father had?
I don't have to think about it, I just know it. It's a stupid question. It's like asking how I worked out that this tablecloth's white. You don't have to work it out.
All right. Now tell me why the patriarch Papadakis was killed.
Oh, it was bound to happen. As soon as Delamere arranged for him to head this new high council, the poor old bastard was doomed. See, Delamere had it all worked out from the start. The only way he could be the single, unchallenged leader was to set up a structure where there was a leader. The Magisterium hasn't had that since, I don't know, hundreds of years ago. But as soon as there was a single leader, all Delamere had to do was have him killed in circumstances that led to panic, then step in and calm that panic with some emergency regulations and modestly offer himself. He's in charge now for life. Unlimited powers. You got to admire that sort of resolution. I could handle him, but no one else can.
In that case, why are you on the run?
What the fuck do you mean? I'm not on the run, Bonneville blustered. I got a secret mission from Delamere himself.
They're looking for you. There's a reward. Didn't you know?
How much?
More than you're worth. Someone will betray you in the end. Now, tell me about the roses. What did they do with the sample of oil?
They analyzed it. The oil from that place has got various properties that they haven't got to the bottom of yet. They need a larger sample. I got hold of a tiny amount. I know a girl in the Geneva laboratory. And in exchange, well, she gave me a piece of blotting paper with a few drops on it. I found out one thing straight away. It protects against the nausea in the new method. With enough of it, you could use the new method and never suffer the ill effects. But I only had that little bit.
Go on. What else?
You know what they mean by dust?
Of course.
With the oil, they can see that. And lines of power, or fields, maybe fields. The girl in the lab said it was a field. And they could see not just chemicals and kinds of light, but human interactions. If Professor Zitsky had touched this specimen but not that one, he showed up somehow, because they could check it against the other things he'd touched. And Professor Zotsky would have his mark on it too, if he had. If Zotsky had been thinking about the thing, or he'd ordered how the experiment was to be set up, he'd show up in the field.
And what was Delamere's reaction to this?
You've got to understand, he's not a simple man. He's got layer on layer of complexity. He's subtle. He seems to contradict himself, and then you see his thoughts several moves ahead. The new High Council, that'll let him do things he wasn't able to before. He's going to send an expedition to this Rose place, Lop Nor, whatever. Not for trade, though. I mean armed. They're going to capture it. He's going to control it all. He's not going to let anyone else have the oil.
What do you know about this armed expedition? Who's commanding it?
Fuck, I don't know, said Bonneville.
He was sounding impatient, bored, and Malcolm could see that he needed the constant attention of a listener to stop him losing concentration and becoming irritated. Want some more coffee?
All right.
Malcolm signalled to the waiter. Bonneville's demon had shut her eyes and let him return her to his shoulder. This girl in the laboratory, Malcolm said. In Geneva.
Nice body. Too emotional, though.
Are you still in contact with her?
Bonneville thrust his right forefinger into and out of his closed left fist several times.
Malcolm knew what the boy wanted then, the sexual admiration of an older man. He let a slight smile into his expression.
She'll find things out for you. She'll do anything. But there's no oil left, I told you.
Have they tried to synthesize it? Bonneville's eyes narrowed. "You sound like you're trying to recruit me as a spy," he said. "Why should I tell you anything?"
The waiter came back with their coffee. Malcolm waited till he'd gone and then said, "The circumstances haven't changed." He wasn't smiling anymore. Bonneville gave an elaborate shrug.
"I've told you plenty. Now, you tell me something. How did that girl Belacqua get hold of my father's alethiometer?"
"As far as I know, it was given to her by the head of her father's college in Oxford. Jordan College."
"Well, how did he get hold of it?"
"I've no idea."
"So why did he give it to her?"
"I know nothing about it at all."
"How do you know her, anyway?"
"I used to teach her."
"When? How old was she? Did she have the alethiometer then?"
"She was about 14, 15. I taught her history. She never mentioned the alethiometer. I certainly never saw it. I had no idea she had it until recently. Is that why Delamere wants to find her?"
"Oh, he'd like the alethiometer, certainly. He'd be glad to have a second one, then he could play me off against the other readers. But that isn't why he wants to find her."
"Well, why does he?"
Malcolm could see the temptation playing over Bonneville's expression. He knew something that Malcolm didn't, and the pleasure of telling it was too strong to ignore.
"You mean you don't know?" he said. "There's a lot of things I don't know. What is it in this case?"
"Oh, I don't know how you failed to know this. Obviously your sources aren't up to much."
Malcolm sipped his coffee and watched Bonneville's knowing smirk broaden. "Obviously," he said. "Well?"
"Delamere is her uncle. He thinks she killed his sister, her mother. He must have been in love with his sister, if you ask me. Obsessed by her, anyway. He wants to punish her, Silvertongue, Belacqua, whatever her name is. Wants to make her pay." Malcolm was profoundly surprised. He'd had no idea that the Mrs. Coulter he'd once met in Hannah Ralph's little house on a winter afternoon just before the Great Flood had any siblings at all.
But why should she not? People did.
Did Lyra know about this brother, this uncle? He wanted to talk to her urgently now, this minute. And he had to show no reaction. He had to feel no reaction. He had to feel no more than mildly interested.
"Does he know where she is now?" he said. "Have you told him?"
"Your turn," said Bonneville. "Tell me about my father. Who killed him?"
"I told you. No one killed him. He drowned."
"I don't believe you. Someone killed him. When I find out who that was, I'll kill him."
"Have you got the nerve to do that?"
"No question. Tell me about his demon. You said something about his demon."
"She was a hyena. She'd lost a leg because he mistreated her. He beat her savagely. I heard it from a man who saw him doing it. He said it made him sick to see it."
"Oh, you think I'll believe that?"
"It's of no interest to me whether you believe it or not."
"Did you ever see him?"
"Only once. I saw his demon and she frightened me. She came out of the bushes in the dark and looked at me and pissed on the path I was walking on. Then he came out and saw what she was doing and laughed. Then they went ahead further into the wood, and I waited for a long time before I dared go on. But I never saw him again."
"How did you know his name?"
"I heard people talking about him."
"Where was this?"
"In Oxford, during the flood."
"You're lying, and you're boasting, and you've got far less control over the alethiometer than you think you have. You read it in a state of confusion and seasickness and guesswork. I don't trust you an inch, because you're a slippery, vicious little brat. But I've given my word. I won't tell Menotti or the others where you are. Unless you try something against me, in which case I won't bother with them. I'll find you and kill you myself."
"Easy to say.
Easy to do."
"Who are you, anyway?"
"An archaeologist. The best advice I can give you is to crawl back to Delamere and apologize fulsomely. Then stay put." Bonneville sneered.
Is your mother still alive? Malcolm said. A flush came into the boy's cheeks.
Never you fucking mind, he said. She's got nothing to do with you.
Malcolm watched him and said nothing. After a minute, Bonneville stood up.
I've had enough, he said.
He picked up his demon and squeezed out past the next table. Malcolm smelled the cologne he was wearing and recognized the scent as one that a number of young men seemed to be affecting, a citrus-based product called Galleon. So Bonneville was conscious of fashion and wanted to be attractive, and perhaps was. It was another fact that might be useful. The young man was holding himself gingerly, as if his ribs still hurt. Malcolm watched him out of the cafe and away past the fountain to be lost in the crowd.
"Do you think he knows about Lyra and Pan not being together?"
said Asta.
"Hard to say. It's the sort of thing he'd boast about if he did.
He'll kill her if he finds her."
"Well, then we must find her first."
Chapter 25 The Princess Cantacuzino. The ferry didn't reach Smyrna till late in the following afternoon. During the day, Lyra hardly moved, staying in her wicker chair and stirring only to fetch some coffee and bread, thinking about what she should do next, and looking through the little notebook, the clavicula. The name Kubicek had written in it was that of a Princess Rosamond Cantacuzino, and it was the rose in her name that decided it. Lyra set off for her house as soon as she left the boat. The princess lived in one of the great houses further along the waterfront. The city was a famous center of trade. In earlier times, merchants had made enormous fortunes from buying and selling carpets, dried fruit, grain, spices, and precious minerals. For the sake of the cool breezes in summer and the views of the mountains, the richest families had long settled in splendid mansions along the palm-shaded corniche. The Cantacuzino house stood back from the road, behind a garden whose neatness and complexity of planting spoke of great wealth. Lyra thought that great wealth would help a lot if you'd lost your demon. You could pay for well-guarded privacy. And thinking that, she wondered if she'd ever get inside the house to meet the princess. She almost quailed. Why did she want to meet her anyway? Well, to ask for advice about the rest of her journey, obviously. And if Kubicek had her on his list, there must have been at least one occasion when she'd agreed to be helpful to those like herself. Courage, Lyra thought. She walked through the gate and along a gravel path between symmetrical beds of tightly pruned roses whose buds were just beginning to show. A gardener at work in a far corner looked up and saw her and straightened his back to watch as she made with all the confidence she could assume for the marble steps up to the entrance. An elderly manservant answered the bell. His crow demon gave one hoarse croak as soon as she saw Lyra, and the old man's hooded eyes flickered with a moment's understanding.
"I hope you can speak English," Lyra said, "because I have little Greek and no Anatolian. I have come to present my compliments to Princess Cantacuzino."
The servant looked her up and down. She knew her clothes were shabby, but she also remembered Father Coram's advice and tried to imitate the way the witches bore themselves, supremely at ease in their ragged scraps of black silk, as if they wore the most elegant couture. The butler inclined his head and said,
"May I tell the princess who is calling?"
"My name is Lyra Silvertongue." He stood aside and invited her to wait in the hall. She looked around. Heavy, dark wood, an elaborate staircase, a chandelier, tall palms in terracotta pots, the smell of beeswax polish, and cool and quiet. The sound of traffic on the corniche, the stir of the air in the outside world were all hushed behind the layers of wealth and custom that hung like heavy curtains all around. The butler returned and said,
"The princess will see you now, Miss Silvertongue. Please, follow me."
He'd come from a door on the ground floor, but now he began to climb the stairs. He moved slowly, wheezing a little, but his posture was soldierly and upright. On the first floor, he opened a door and announced her. and Lyra walked past into a room flooded with light, overlooking the bay and the harbour and the distant mountains. It was very large, and it seemed full of life. An ivory-coloured grand piano covered in a dozen or more silver-framed photograms, many modern paintings, crowded white-painted bookshelves, and elegant light-coloured furniture all made Lyra like it at once. A very old lady sat in a brocaded armchair near the great windows, dressed all in black. Lyra approached her. She wondered for a moment if she ought to curtsy, but decided immediately that it would look ridiculous, and simply said, "Good afternoon, Princess. It's very good of you to see me."
"Is that how you were brought up to address a princess?"
The old woman's voice was dry, astringent, amused. "No, that didn't form part of my lessons at all. I can do several other things quite well, though."
"I'm glad to hear it. Bring that chair forward and sit down. Let me look at you."
Lyra did as she was told, and looked back calmly as the old woman scrutinized her. The old woman was both fierce and vulnerable, and Lyra wondered what her demon had been, and whether it would be polite to ask.
"Who were your people?" said the princess.
"My father's name was Asriel, Lord Asriel, and my mother was not his wife. She was called Mrs. Coulter." "How did you know? I mean, why did you say were? How could you tell they weren't alive?"
"I can tell an orphan when I see one. I met your father once."
"Did you?"
"It was at a reception in the Egyptian embassy in Berlin. It must have been 30 years ago. He was a very handsome young man, and very rich."
"He lost his wealth when I was born."
"Why was that?"
"He wasn't married to my mother, and there was a court case."
"Oh, lawyers. Have you any money, child?"
"None at all."
"Then you will be of no interest to lawyers, and all the better for it. Who gave you my name?"
"A man in Prague. He was called Vaslav Kubicek."
"Ah, a very interesting man. A scholar of some repute. Modest, unassuming. Did you know of him before you went to Prague?"
"No, not at all. I had no idea there could be anyone else who... I mean, without... He was very helpful to me."
"Why are you traveling? And where are you going?"
"I'm going to Central Asia, to a place called Tashbilak, where there's a botanical research station. I'm going there to find out the answer to a puzzle. A mystery, really."
"Tell me about your demon."
"Pantaleimon."
"A good Greek name."
"He settled in the form of a pine marten. He and I discovered we could separate when I was about 12. We had to. At least, I had to keep a promise, which meant leaving him behind and going into a place where he couldn't come. Nothing, almost nothing, has ever felt worse. But after a while, we found each other again, and I think he forgave me. And we were together after that, though we had to keep our separating very secret. We didn't think anyone could do it except witches. But for the last year or so, we've been quarreling. We couldn't stand each other. That was horrible. And one day I woke up and he'd just gone. So I'm searching for him, really. I'm following clues. Little things that don't make rational sense. In Prague, I met a magician who gave me a clue, and I'm relying on chance. It was by chance that I met Mr. Kubicek."
"There's a great deal you're not telling me."
"I don't know how long you'll be interested for."
"You don't suppose my life is so full of fascinating events that I can pass up the chance to listen to a stranger in the same depleted condition as I am myself?"
"Well, it might be full of fascinating events, I mean.
I'm sure there's no shortage of people who'd like to meet you, or friends who could come and talk. Perhaps you have a family.
I have no offspring, if that's what you mean. No husband. But in another sense, I am smothered by family. This city, this country, are full of Canto Cusinos. What I have instead of a family is, yes, I have a handful of friends, but they are embarrassed by me. They make allowances. They avoid painful subjects. They are full of kindly understanding. And as a result, conversation with them is a kind of purgatory. When Mr. Kubicek came to see me, I was nearly dead with boredom and despair. Now, the people who come here through him and through two or three other people of our sort in other places are the most welcome of guests. Will you take some tea with me?
I would love to. The princess rang a little silver bell on the table beside her.
When did you arrive in Smyrna? She said.
This afternoon. I came straight from the port. Princess, why did your demon leave you? The old lady held up a hand. She heard the door open. When the butler came in, she said,
"Tea, Hamid."
And he nodded deeply and went out again. The princess listened. When she was satisfied that the servant had gone, she turned back to Lyra.
He was a particularly beautiful black cat. He left me because he fell in love with someone else. He became utterly fascinated by a dancer. A nightclub dancer.
Her tone made it clear that she meant someone little better than a prostitute. Lyra was silent, intrigued.
You will be wondering, the princess went on, how he could possibly have come to know such a woman. My social circle and hers would normally never touch. But I had a brother whose physical appetites were insatiable, and whose gift for making unsuitable alliances caused the family a great deal of embarrassment. He introduced the woman one evening into a soiree. He was perfectly open about it. "This young woman is my mistress," he would say when meeting people. And, to do her justice, she was remarkably pretty and graceful. I could feel her attractiveness myself, and my poor demon became besotted at once.
"Your poor demon?"
"Oh, I felt sorry for him. To be so abjectly dependent on a woman of that kind, it was a sort of madness. I felt every little quiver of it, of course. And I tried to speak to him about it, but he refused to listen, refused to control his feelings. Well, I dare say they were beyond control."
"What about her demon?"
"Oh, he was a marmoset or something of that kind. Lazy, incurious, vain, quite indifferent to what was going on. My brother persisted in bringing the girl to the opera, to race meetings, to receptions, and whenever I was present too, my demon's obsession would force me to seek her company and experience his passion for her. It became unendurable. He would get as close as he could and talk quietly, whispering into her ear, while her own demon preened and yawned nearby. In the end..."
The door opened, and she stopped while the butler came in with the tray, which he set on the little table to her right. He bowed and left, and she completed the sentence.
"In the end, it became notorious. Everyone knew about it. I have never been so unhappy."
"How old were you?"
19, 20, I can't remember. It would have been the natural thing for me to accept the attentions of any one of a number of young men my parents thought suitable, and to marry, and so on. But this absurdity made that impossible. I became an object of ridicule.
She spoke calmly, as if the young woman who had been her 20-year-old self was someone else entirely. She turned to the tray and poured tea into 2 pretty cups.
"How did it end?" said Lyra.
"I begged. I pleaded with him. But he was lost in his madness. I said we would both die if he didn't stop. But nothing would make him stay with me. I even, and this will show you how abject a human being can become, I even left my parents and went to live with her myself."
"The dancer? You went to live with her?"
"It was reckless. I pretended to be in love with her, and she was happy enough with that. I lived with her, and I forsook all my family responsibilities. I shared her bed, her table, her wretched occupation, because I could dance, too. Oh, I was graceful. I was no less pretty than she was. She had a little talent, but no more than that. Together, we attracted a bigger audience. We had a great success. We danced in every nightclub from Alexandria to Athens. We were offered a fortune to dance in Morocco, and an even greater one to dance in South America. But my demon wanted more. Always more. He wanted to be hers, and not mine. Her demon became a slave of Poppy, which didn't affect her. But she turned to my demon. And when he felt his own obsession returned, I knew it was time for me to leave. I was ready to die. One night, we were in Beirut. One night, I tore myself away from them. He was clinging to her. She was holding him tight, crushing him to her breast. All 3 of us were sobbing with pain and terror. But I wouldn't stop. I wrenched myself apart from him and left him there with her. From that day to this, I have been alone. I came back to my family, regarded it all as a mildly amusing addition to the family legends. I could not marry, of course, in my solitary state. No one would have had me.
Lyra sipped her tea. It was delicately scented with jasmine. When did you meet my father?
It was a year before all that.
Lyra thought, but that can't be true. He wouldn't have been old enough. What do you remember most about your time with the dancer? She said.
Oh, that's easy.
The hot nights.
Our narrow bed. Her slender body. The scent of her flesh. That will never leave me.
And were you in love with her? Or were you still pretending?
You can pretend and pretend that sort of thing until it comes true, you know.
The old woman's face was calm and deeply lined. Her eyes were very small amid the wrinkles, but bright and still. And your demon?
Never came back.
She died, the dancer, a long time ago.
but he never came back to me. I think he might have gone to Al-Khan al-Azraq. The Blue Hotel. Is it true, that story? About the ruined city where no one but demons can live? I believe so. Some of my visitors, people from Mr. Kubicek, I mean, have been on their way there. No one has come back, as far as I know.
Lyra's mind was racing over deserts and mountains, to a ruined city stark and silent under moonlight.
"Now I have told you my story," said the princess. "You must tell me something remarkable. What have you seen on your journey that might interest an old lady without a demon?"
Lyra said, "When I was in Prague, it seems a long time ago, but it was really only last week, I got off the train, and before I'd even tried to find out about the timetable, Mr. Kubicek spoke to me. It was as if he'd been waiting for me, and as it turned out, he had." She recounted the entire story of the furnace man, and was rewarded by utter stillness and concentration. When she finished, the princess sighed with satisfaction.
"And he was the magician's son," she said.
"Well, so Agrippa claimed. Cornelis and Dinessa."
"It was a cruel game to play with him and his demon."
"I thought so too, but he was determined to find Dinessa, and he did."
"Love,"
said the princess. "Tell me more about the Blue Hotel," said Lyra, "or what's the other name? Madina al-Kamar, the City of the Moon. Why is it called that?"
"Oh, no one knows. It's a very old idea. My nurse used to tell me ghost stories when I was very young, and it was she who told me about the Blue Hotel. Where are you going next?"
"Aleppo."
"Then I shall give you the names of some people there who are in our condition. One of them might know a little about it. Of course, it is a subject of horror and superstitious dread, not to be spoken of in front of people who are entire and easily frightened."
"Of course," said Lyra, and sipped the last of her tea. "This is such a lovely room. Do you play the piano?"
"It plays by itself," said the princess. "Go and pull out the ivory knob on the right of the keyboard."
Lyra did, and at once a mechanism inside the piano began playing the keys, which were depressed as if by an invisible pair of hands. The sounds of a sentimental love song of 50 years before filled the room. Lyra was delighted, and smiled at the princess.
"Le bleu," the old lady said. "We used to dance to that."
Lyra looked back at the piano, at the multitude of silver-framed photograms, and suddenly fell still.
"What is it?"
said the princess, startled by Lyra's expression. Lyra pressed in the knob to stop the music, and picked up one of the photograms with a trembling hand.
Who is this?" she said.
"Bring it to me."
The old lady took it and peered through a pair of pince-nez.
"Oh, it is my nephew, Olivier," she said. "My great-nephew, I suppose I should say. Do you know him? Olivier Bonneville?"
"Yes. That is, I haven't actually met him, but he thinks I've got something that belongs to him, and he's been trying to get it back."
"And have you?"
"It belongs to me. My father gave it to me. Monsieur Bonneville is wrong, but he won't accept it."
"Always a very stubborn boy. His father was a ne'er-do-well who probably died a violent death. Olivier is related to me on his mother's side, and she, too, is dead. He has expectations of me. If it were not for those, I should certainly never see him.
Is he in Smyrna now?
Oh, I hope not. If he comes here, I shall say nothing about you. And if he asks, I shall lie through my teeth. I am a good liar.
I used to be good at lying when I was young, Lyra said. She was feeling a little calmer. These days I find it more difficult.
Come here and kiss me, my dear, said the princess, and held out her hands.
Lyra was glad to do so. The old lady's papery cheeks smelled of lavender.
If you do go to Alkan al-Azraq, said the princess, and if it really is a ruined city inhabited by demons, and if you see a black cat, and if his name is Fanurius, tell him that I would be glad to see him again before I die, but that he had better not leave it too long.
I shall.
I hope that your quest goes well, and that you solve your mystery. There is a young man involved, I take it?
Lyra blinked. The princess must have meant Malcolm. Of course, he was young to her.
Well, she said, not my great-nephew. Of course not. Now, if you come this way again, do not fail to come and see me, or I shall haunt you.
She turned to a little ormolu desk beside her, took out a piece of paper and a fountain pen, and wrote on it for a minute or so. Then she blew on it to dry the ink, and folded it in half before giving it to Lyra.
One of these people will be sure to help, she said.
Goodbye. I'm very grateful indeed. I shan't forget the things you've told me. Lyra left and closed the door quietly. The butler was waiting in the hall to see her out. When she left the garden, she walked a little further until she was out of sight of the house, and then leaned against a wall to recover her composure. She had been nearly as shocked as if Bonneville had come into the room himself. He had the power to disturb her, even as a picture. This had all the quality of a warning from the secret Commonwealth. It said, "Be on your guard. You never know when he'll appear." Even in Smyrna, she thought, he might find her.
Chapter 26. The Brotherhood of This Holy Purpose. By the evening of the day after his encounter with Olivier Bonneville, Malcolm was in a city 300 miles south of Constantinople. It was the capital of the rose-growing district in the ancient Roman province of Pisidia, and he'd gone there to meet an English journalist called Brian Parker, a foreign correspondent who specialized in security matters, whom he knew from Oakley Street business. Malcolm told him a little about the journey to Central Asia and what had sent him on that quest, and Parker instantly said, "Well, then you must come with me to a public meeting this evening. I think we can show you something interesting." As they walked to the theatre where the meeting was due to take place, Parker explained that the rose-growing and processing industry was a valuable part of the region's economy, and it was now under a great strain. "What's the source of the problem?" said Malcolm as they went into the old theatre. "A group of men. No one knows where they come from, but they're always referred to as the Men from the Mountains. They've been burning rose gardens, attacking the growers, smashing their factories. The authorities can't seem to do anything about it." The auditorium was crowded already, but they found a couple of seats at the back. There were a large number of middle-aged or older men wearing respectable suits and ties, and Malcolm guessed them to be the owners of the gardens. There were several women, too, with sun-browned faces. He'd gathered from Parker that the industry was intensely conservative, with differing roles played by men and women workers, so perhaps these were some of the women who gathered the flowers, while the men were involved in the distilling of the rose water and the production of the oil. Apart from them, the other members of the audience seemed to be townspeople, some of them possibly journalists or local politicians. Men were coming and going on the stage, some engaged in erecting a large banner, which Parker said was that of the trade association sponsoring the meeting. Eventually, every seat was taken, with people standing at the back and along the sides. It was too full to satisfy any fire regulation that Malcolm was familiar with, but perhaps they had a more relaxed attitude to such things here. There were armed policemen, though, at every entrance, looking nervous, Malcolm thought. If there was any trouble at all this evening, a lot of people could easily get hurt. Finally, the organizers decided that they were ready to begin. A group of men in suits, carrying briefcases or bulging files of paper, came out onto the stage, and some of them were recognized and applauded or cheered by the audience. Four of them sat at a table, and a fifth came to a lectern and started to speak. At first, the loudspeakers howled with feedback, and he stood back alarmed and tapped the microphone, and a technician hurried out to adjust it. Malcolm was watching everything, looking around unobtrusively, and as the speaker began again, he noticed something. The armed police had quietly vanished. There'd been a man at each of the six exits. Now there were none. Parker was whispering a précis of what the speaker was saying. "Welcome to everyone. Time of crisis in the industry. Soon hear a report from each of the rose-growing regions." Now he's reading out some figures. This man is not the greatest speaker in the world. Basically, production is down, turnover is down. Now he's introducing the first speaker, a grower from Barris. There was a scatter of applause as the next speaker left the table and came to the lectern. Whereas the previous man had a bureaucratic manner and a soporific voice, this older man spoke with force and passion from the start. Parker said, "He's telling what happened at his factory. Some men from the mountains came early one morning and gathered all his workers together and forced them at gunpoint to burn down the factory, feeding the flames with the precious oil. Then they brought a bulldozer and dug up every corner of his gardens and poured poison, I don't know what sort, on the land so nothing could grow there again. Look, he's weeping with passion. This was a place owned by his great-great-grandfather, cared for by his family for over 100 years, employing all his children and 38 workers. Murmurs of anger or sympathy or agreement came from the audience. Clearly, many others had had similar experiences. He's saying, where was the police force? Where was the army? Where was any protection for honest citizens like himself and his family? It seems his son was killed in a skirmish with these men, who simply vanished afterwards. No one was caught, no one punished. Where is the justice? That's what he's saying. The man's voice had risen to a pitch of rage and sorrow, and the audience joined in, clapping, shouting, stamping. Shaking his head, sobbing, the farmer left the lectern and sat down. "Is there anyone from the government here?" Malcolm said. "The only politicians here are from the local administration. No national figures. What's been the response of the national government so far?" "Oh, concern, of course. Sympathy, stern warnings. But also a curious tone of caution, as if they're too frightened to criticize these vandals." "Curious, as you say." "Yes, and it's making people angry. This next speaker is from the Wholesalers Trade Association." He was another dull speaker. Parker whispered the gist of what he said, but Malcolm was more interested in what was going on in the auditorium. Parker noticed and said, "What? What are you looking at?" "Two things. Firstly, the police have vanished. And secondly, they've closed all the exits." They were sitting at the right-hand end of the last row but one, which was close to the exit on that side. It had been a noise from there that had alerted Malcolm. It sounded like the sliding of a bolt. "You want me to go on translating this dull man?" "No. But be ready to smash that door open with me when the time comes. They open inwards. But they're not heavy or strong. Something's going to happen, Brian. Thank you for suggesting this." They didn't have to wait long. Before the speaker had finished, three men appeared on the platform behind him, carrying guns. Two had rifles, one had a pistol. The audience gasped and fell still. And the speaker turned to see what had happened, and grasped the lectern and went pale. Out of the corner of his eye, Malcolm caught a movement at the other side of the hall. He turned his head a little way to look, and saw a door on that side open briefly to let in a man with a rifle. Then it shut again. Malcolm turned all around. The same thing had happened at all six exits. The young man with the revolver had pushed the speaker aside and begun to talk himself. His eyes were pale, but his black hair and beard were long and thick. His voice was clear and light and harsh in quality, and full of calm conviction. Malcolm leaned his head a little sideways, and Parker whispered, "He's saying everything you know is going to change. Things that you are familiar with will become strange and alien, and things you have never imagined will become normal. This is beginning now in many parts of the world, not just in Pisidia." The men who'd entered with him came to the two sides of the stage and faced out into the audience. No one moved. Malcolm could almost feel everyone holding their breath. Parker went on as the man continued. "You and your families and your workers have been tending your gardens for far too long. The authority does not want roses, and you are displeasing him by growing so many. The smell of them is sickening to him. It is like the dung of the devil himself. Those who grow roses and those who deal in oils and perfumes are pleasing the devil and offending God. We have come to tell you this." He paused for a moment, and then the farmer who had spoken so passionately couldn't contain himself for another moment. He pushed back his chair and stood up. All three gunmen on the stage turned to him at once, guns pointed at his heart. The man spoke without the microphone, but in a voice so loud and clear that everyone heard. Parker whispered, "He says this is a new teaching. He has not heard it before. His fathers, his family, his cousins who grow roses in the next village, they all thought they were doing the will of God by tending the flowers he created and preserving the beauty of their scent. This doctrine is new and strange, and it will be strange to everyone he knows and to everyone in this hall." The gunman spoke, and Parker translated, "It replaces every other doctrine, because it is the word of God. No other doctrine is necessary." The farmer came out from behind the table and confronted the gunman directly. His broad and stocky frame, his red face, the passion in his eyes made a vivid contrast with the cool and slender young man holding the revolver. The farmer spoke again, even more loudly, in what was almost a bellow. "What will become of my family and my workers? What will become of the merchants and craftsmen who depend on the roses we grow? Will it please God to see them all poor and starving?" The gunman answered, and Malcolm leaned close to hear Parker's whisper. "It will please God to see them no longer involved in that evil trade. It will please him to see them turn away from their false gardens and set their eyes on the one true garden, which is paradise." Without moving his head, Malcolm looked to left and right and saw the men on either side slowly scanning the audience, back to front and back again, their rifles unwaveringly swinging from side to side with their gaze at head level to the audience. The farmer said, "What are you going to do then?" The gunman replied, "The question is not what we're going to do. There is no question that needs to be asked about us because we submit to the will of God, which is without question. I can't see the will of God. I see my roses, my children, my workers. You need not worry. We shall tell you the will of God. We understand how your life is complicated, how things seem to contradict one another, how everything is full of doubt. We have come to make things clear." The farmer swung his head and lowered it like a bull and seemed to be gathering his strength. He spread his feet as if to find a firmer purchase on the earth, though it was only a wooden stage. And finally he said, "And what is the will of God?" The young gunman said, and Parker whispered, "That you dig up and burn every one of your rose bushes and smash every piece of your distilling apparatus, that you destroy every vessel that contains the dung of Satan, which you call perfume and oil. That is the will of God. In his infinite mercy, he has sent me and my companions to inform you of this and make sure it is done, so that your women and your workers may live lives that are pleasing to God instead of filling the air with a foul stench from the bowels of hell." The farmer tried to say something else, but the gunman lifted his hand and held the revolver only a foot away from the old man's head. "When you light that fire," he said, "the fire that will consume your gardens and your factories, it will light a beacon of truth and purity to shine all over the world. You should rejoice at being given this opportunity.
my companions in the brotherhood of this holy purpose are numbered in the thousands of thousands. The word of God has spread so fast that it is like a forest fire, and it will spread further and further until all the world is burning with the love of God and the joy of perfect obedience to his will.
All this time, the farmer's demon, a heavy-beaked old raven, had been raising her wings and snapping her beak on his shoulder, and the gunman's, a large and beautiful sand-coloured desert cat, had been standing tense and watchful at his side. Then the farmer shouted, "I will never burn my roses! I will never deny the truth of my senses! The flowers are beautiful, and their scent is the very breath of heaven! You are wrong!"
And the raven plunged down towards the cat, and the cat leaped up towards the raven, but even before they met, the gunman pulled the trigger and sent a bullet through the old man's head. The raven vanished in midair, and the farmer fell dead, blood pulsing from the hole in his skull. The audience cried out, but any further noise was stilled at once by the movement of the gunmen, who stepped forward, all of them, and raised their rifles to their shoulders.